Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and a dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Tonight, I'm proud to be bringing you Living Theurgy. Our guests are Apollonius and Tony Merzwicki. Greetings and welcome, O Theurgists. How are you today?
Very good, Hercules. How are you?
I'm doing phenomenally well. I've been looking forward to this conversation since last month. So I'm glad that we're here. And Tony, how are you?
I'm doing really well, too, and I hope that you are, too.
Yes, I am. And you guys had exciting things going on. Tony, you published a new blog, and Apollonius, you're working on your book, which I'm greatly looking forward to.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I've sent off my manuscript, and I've got a contract. So, you know, with a little luck in a year or something like that, it'll be out.
Oh, that is awesome. Can you share what publisher it'll be released by?
Yeah, I think so. It's Llewellyn.
Okay.
Published my previous book, too.
Yes, I like working with Llewellyn. They started communicating again. During the chunk of the pandemic, they weren't very communicative, but now they started communicating again, so I'm having a really good time interacting with them.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I've always had an excellent interaction with them. So very, very professional and competent.
And actually, we're going to be having more Llewellyn authors on several of the podcasts going forward. They did a series on ancestors, and that's something I decided to focus on for the quarter. So three books have been released on ancestors or will be released during the time I'm doing the shows. So I'm really looking forward to meeting new authors. I met you guys through Llewellyn, and it was awesome. So, So the book is in final form now.
Well, you know, this is, at least in my experience, it's a... it's never in final form till it's in print.
Okay.
So, you know, the manuscript is complete. I've basically done on it all that I can do at this stage. I'm still reproofreading it and tinkering with some of my translations and things like that. But basically it's a complete manuscript and it's there in their hands. So, they'll be looking at it and reviewing it and, maybe making suggestions for substantial changes. I don't know. Again, my experience on my previous books has been they make very good suggestions. You know, they because you get so much into when you're writing a book, you get so much into it that, you lose sight sometimes, or I do at least, of what your typical readers maybe are interested in and what the background is and so forth. And so it always helps to have other readers looking at it with fresh eyes and saying, well, you know, this part here really isn't very clear, or you haven't motivated this well, or, you know, whatever, all sorts of various ways it can be improved. And I find that very helpful. I anticipate that there'll be some suggested changes to it, and so I'll be working those into the manuscript over the next few months. And So that's why I say, you know, it's for the moment it's done, it's complete, but I have no doubt that I'll be doing some more work on it before it finally makes its way into print. So it does all make it a better product, a better book, and, you know, better able to help people, which is really what I want the book to do, is help people understand Pleathon's philosophy and be able to apply it in their lives. So that's why I really value the editing and the feedback I get from Llewellyn.
And you said it's going to take around a year to come out?
Yeah, I think so. They have to figure out exactly where it's going to fit into their publication schedule, and so something like that. A year, maybe a little more than a year, but within that time frame, sometime in 2022. So it seems such a long way off, but you know, it's there's just a lot that has to be done between now and then.
Yeah, time has been zooming. The older I get, it seems time seems to move quicker. So it'll be upon us with the blink of an eye, unfortunately. And how did your training go with Theurgia University?
Oh, I think that went fine. I did a lecture on Pleathon. I think I don't know if Tony, if you're able to go to my Pantheacon lecture on Pleathon. I've forgotten now, but it was similar to the one I did there. And but I contracted it a little bit because I also Jean-Louis had suggested that I finish up with a guided visualization or guided meditation of some sort. So what I actually decided to do, because we were having this webinar on the New Year's Day in Pleathon's calendar. In Pleathon's calendar, the new year begins with the new moon following the winter solstice. And so Jean-Louis had scheduled the webinar for that day. So what I was able to do is actually go through most of what would have been Pleathon's New Year celebration. And this is part of his book that has not been translated into English previously, as far as I know. And it's a quite lengthy invocation. And of course, we couldn't do any of the ritual actions because it was all over the internet. But I kind of talked my way through those too, so you could do it as a guided visualization. So I was very happy to be able to do that, to be able to basically, it took about half an hour, I think, to do that part, and basically to go through that whole ritual, because in Neoplatonism, the Platonic ideas are essentially the gods, and the connection between us and the gods is established by basically activating images of those gods in our psyches. And so the invocation, basically by talking about the various gods and their attributes and how they interact with each other, which is what Pleathon's text does, is basically activating those images within our psyches and in that way connecting us to the gods themselves. So so I think it went very well. I got good feedback on it, and I don't know if it's out there anywhere on the web or not, or whether it's publicly available or not, but I'll try and find out.
Thank you. Yes,
I was
unable to experience it when it was happening, but I would gladly visit it now because I'm really fascinated by this book, and I'm waiting to experience more of it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate Jean-Louis not here this evening, or we could ask him.
Yes.
I'll try and find out from him where it is.
I was intending to.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that.
That is great. That is great. And again, 2022 will be upon us very quickly. So I'm looking forward to reading the final version of the book. Tony, you just wrote a blog on mental health in ancient Greece. And again, I got it in between shows, so I had a lot to do, so I wasn't able to look it over. But I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
Sure. But before I start, I was just going to congratulate Apollonius on getting the manuscript finished. I'm also really looking forward to seeing the book in print. And I attended his talk at Pantheon, and it was excellent. Unfortunately, like you, I missed the online talk, but if it's like the one that was at Pantheon, it'll be absolutely excellent. So I'm really looking forward to it coming out in print. Yeah, so I just wrote a blog on mental health, and I wanted to point out how prevalent it was in American society. So basically, if you stood 10 Americans up against a wall, then out of those 10, two would have mental health issues, one would be seeking treatment actively, and the other one will be trying to sweep it all under the carpet. So it affects a huge percentage of the population, and the people who try to hide from admitting that they have it are basically worried about being stigmatized by people around them, friends, family, people at work, and so on. So it is quite a serious issue, and it was an issue that was addressed by the ancient Greeks as well. So I wanted to focus on how the ancient Greeks looked at mental health issues. And there was a guy called Dr. Nicholas Kardaras who wrote a book called How Plato and Pythagoras Can Save Your Life. And he basically claims that depression and anxiety can be cured by a holistic way of living, which was known in the ancient world as bios pythagorikos, which means the Pythagorean way of life. So it entails a healthy vegetarian diet, rigorous physical exercise, which you and I are both doing, and yes, philosophical group discussions, which was very big amongst the Greeks. And they were meant to make the person better understand their place in the universe and their purpose within the universe. And while I didn't go into it in the blog, I might actually do a follow-up blog on it. I think one of the primary ways of addressing issues like depression, apart from incorporating, diet, exercise, fresh air, sunshine, various supplements, is to think of yourself as being connected to the universe and everything around you. It's when you see yourself as separate from everyone else that you kind of wallow in self-pity, and there are various issues that can crop up. But while you put your focus on others and perhaps engage in some sort of service activities like volunteering, seeing yourself as part of a greater whole, then that is actually a very good way of overcoming depression. I've heard people claim that while meditation, exercise, and medication are effective, actively volunteering for them works even better because of that feeling of being interconnected with everyone. And I've just been noticing during the shutdown that depression rates are going through the roof, especially amongst young people. For us who are somewhat older, being locked away isn't as big of an issue. But if you think back to what we were like in our teens and 20s and 30s, we wanted to go out and party constantly. So there are all these young people who are almost imprisoned at home. There's nowhere for them to go, nothing for them to do. And so depression is becoming quite a big issue.
Yeah.
So I just keep coming across more and more references to depression, mental health issues, and the like, and I thought I'd look into it. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
It sounds great, and I'm glad that you're going to be following it up with another article. I can vouch for the effectiveness of volunteering. I volunteer a great deal. One of the things I've done in my career My career has been a weird combination of human services, education, and entertainment. One of the things I did for over 16 years was I used to create student intern volunteer programs. And these were in hospitals and in nonprofit organizations. And, you know, and when I had my show, I created an internship program, you know, on TV production. People in giving and being part of something larger, they learn, and I would help them, you know, like process what they were learning and apply it. You know, like, for instance, like one example, like in workforce development, you know, what are you learning where you're interning? How do you communicate that to somebody else? How do you turn it into marketable skills that you could then, you know, put in different combinations and present to prospective employers? But it's very satisfying, you know, whether you're doing it for workforce or getting ahead in your education, whether you're doing it to become more part of your community. People get a lot out of volunteering. I know I certainly do.
Mm. I know Brandy does a lot as well.
Yes, yes.
She always talks about the incredible work that she does, and I'm missing not having her on the show.
I miss her and I miss Jean-Louis, but this gives us the
opportunity, of course.
To get to communicate a bit longer. So I'm happy, you know, I have you guys here.
with Jean-Louis, he's just moved into a new home and doesn't have Wi-Fi set up. Otherwise, he would definitely be here with us. So he's here in spirit.
Yeah, they're both here in spirit.
Absolutely.
Apollonius, you know a lot and have written a lot about the ancient philosophers. How do you respond to Tony's article?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to read it, so I just know it from what you've just been discussing. I think, you know, certainly there's a lot of very interesting stuff concerning how Pythagoras and the Platonists in general used music in particular as a way of basically dealing with mental health issues. There's a number of stories about how Pythagoras cured various people's problems that way. And, you know, people have reinvented that, and there's a fairly thriving area of music therapy.
Yes,
that deals with this, and Pleithon, in fact, talked about it too. This is something that in working on this book, I found out is that he prescribes for the various hymns different musical modes, essentially scales, some of the different ancient scales, which the ancient Greeks understood the different scales to have different psychological effects. So you would use one scale if you were trying to kind of energize people, and another scale if you're trying to pacify them or relax them, I should say, and so forth. And so Pleithon talks about the four scales that he uses and their different effects. So I've put that in the book as well, so people can, if they want, improvise their own music to go with these hymns. And the invocations are also supposed to be done in these different modes. So, but unfortunately, we don't have any music. If Pleithon composed music for the hymns, that hasn't survived. Mm. So I think that's very important. But, you know, the bios in ancient Greek is a very important concept because, you know, the basic meaning is life, you know, and we have it in English words like biology. But especially in the context of philosophy, like Tony was talking about, bios really means a way of life. And so the bios Pythagoricos was the Pythagorean way of life, or a bios Platonicos would be a Platonic way of life. And the idea that it's the whole extent of your life, and it really infuses every different aspect of your life. So your spiritual practices, your work practices, your education, your interpersonal relations, your emotions, every aspect of your life. And that's really what ancient philosophies were trying to do, was teach a whole comprehensive way of living all aspects of your life. And so I think, you know, it's been said that, you know, the ancient philosophers really were doing very much the job of modern psychotherapists. And, you know, they had a talking cure, is what we usually associate that with psychoanalysis. But, you know, they talked about a talking cure, basically helping a person through the words you use on them. And there's a whole continuum between what we might think of as more just a helping somebody think through a problem, for example. And there's a whole continuum from that use of language through to actual magical spells. So it's the therapy of the word extends through, you know, strictly rational sorts of use of the word to more magical use of the word. And as I think I've mentioned before, ancient Stoic philosophy has been quite literally repackaged into modern cognitive behavioral therapy. So there again, people have discovered at least some aspects of ancient philosophy that work very well and that can be applied in our world today. Now, they don't necessarily adopt all of the other ideas from Stoicism, although modern Stoicism has in the past decade or so become a very thriving form of modern philosophy too. So people have rediscovered the value of Stoicism. And I would argue, you know, back more to the subject of theurgy, that where Neoplatonism goes beyond Stoicism is in giving us these techniques, not just for living well on this earth, but also for contacting the divine realms. And in that sense, putting our lives in a larger context and giving us a better understanding of what we should be doing, how we should be acting, and how we should be living our lives more generally. So I think that there's a lot we can learn from ancient philosophy, and particularly from Neoplatonic philosophy. And by that, I include the whole tradition beginning at Pythagoras, going through Plato, Plotinus, and then on into the later Neoplatonists, such as Iamblichus. If we look at it, as we've talked about before, also I think, you know, in my mind, and I think I can defend this quite a bit, that really that whole theurgical tradition continues up into Jungian psychology and into the analytical techniques that are used in Jungian psychology, such as active imagination. So there again, we have a case where, you know, modern versions of these ancient spiritual practices can be applied very practically to modern concerns as well. You know, Jung basically said that all addictions are spiritual problems. People become addicted to, say, substances or activities because there's some large spiritual hole in their life and they're trying to fill it with something else. And so he always took an addiction as a evidence of a spiritual problem to be solved for the person, which then these sorts of techniques can be used to try and solve that problem. And in fact, Jung, as you may know, was very much influential in getting Alcoholics Anonymous founded. The founder of it had been essentially helped by Jung and wanted to apply the technique more generally. So that's, again, one modern or contemporary application of what ultimately are quite ancient spiritual practices.
So these spiritual practices from antiquity live on, although not immediately recognizable, their roots go back into antiquity. And in Greek, the word therapia, in its more ancient sense, meant to tend to an altar.
Well, and also, it also means both cure and care, which I like also. Because, you know, and again, it comes back to exercise. You know, you may do physical therapy if you've been injured, but then you also just exercise to maintain your physical health and to improve your physical health. So the two sides of both curing and caring, I think, very much go together. This also, there's been movements in positive psychology, is what it's called now, where you're not so much trying to cure a mental health problem as to just maintain mental health that you may already have and even improve it. So, yeah, I think these ideas are very applicable today. Sometimes they have to be repackaged. You know, you see this in Buddhism, for example. When Buddhism moves into different cultures, it kind of takes on some of the cultural trappings of each culture it moves into. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes on with all of these ancient traditions. You have to make some adaptations so people understand them and so that they're comfortable practicing them as well. And, you know, those are sort of the details and the trappings that sometimes can be changed without affecting the core practice itself.
And that's an excellent intro to cultural appropriation, which is where we're going next, because you brought up some very valid points, and I want to return to them. But first, I want to give Tony a chance to respond to what you said.
Well, Apollonius certainly makes some absolutely excellent points. And one thing that I really like about what he does is that he shows just how relevant the ancient philosophers were in this day and age. So Stoicism being very applicable to cognitive therapy and the like, it's all very important. But I actually wanted to go back to my blog. There were a couple of things that I forgot to mention. These are actually the most important things, the theurgical aspects, and that is that just for general healing, like you'd be calling on Asclepius, but there are two particular deities that I focused on in the blog. Firstly, there's the god Pan, and he's capable of causing panic in individuals, animals, and armies. So, and the name Pan actually gives rise to the word panic. So he would tie in with panic disorder and more general anxiety disorders. So one thing that I suggest is that if someone is suffering from an anxiety disorder, then in addition to whatever treatment they're undergoing, they should be venerating Pan. So I've included the Orphic Hymn to Pan. I used Patrick Dunn's translation as always. And the other daemon that I focused on, although there's very little information about her, is Oisus. She was the personified spirit or daemon of misery and woe, distress and suffering. She was one of the malevolent children of Nyx or Night, and her Roman name was Miseria. So she would tie in with depression. So if someone actually is suffering from the debilitating effects of depression, then in conjunction with what treatment they're undergoing, it would be useful to call on her. Sadly, there's no visual representations of it. There are no pictures, no statues, nothing that I could find. There's no invocation to her either. Hesiod refers to her as painful Isis, so people would have to craft their own invocation, but I would suggest incorporating the word painful in there. So just wanted to point that out. But again, just wanted to emphasize that I love the way Apollonius always points out how relevant ancient philosophies are to this day and age. So rather than reinventing the wheel, it's always good to go back to first principles.
I agree. I'm just going to throw in my two cents and then we'll move to the next topic. One of the things I did in my career, too, was supervise activity therapists and creative arts therapists in a psychiatric hospital. And one of the things that impressed me about the creative arts therapies is that they bypass words. So some of the other ones, aside from music therapy, were art therapy and drama therapy and dance therapy. So they would help a person get in contact with what was going on and express it without using words. And some of the things that were difficult to get to through conversation would come out very clearly through whatever the creative art therapy happened to be. So for instance, in art therapy, the use of shapes, colors, and things like that, it was almost magical, like reading an aura. You know, you'd be able to see very clearly into some of the things that are going on inside the person. So all of the creative arts therapies are indeed a resurrection of things that the ancients did, and they're phenomenally powerful. So onwards. Now, Apollonius, you pointed out that these ancient philosophies, as they go into different cultures, they are mutated and made to adapt to the new transplanted culture and the needs of the people in that culture. I'm correct in stating what you said?
Yes, I think that's generally true. I mean, certainly the ancient Greeks claimed to have borrowed from everybody they
yeah.
came into contact yeah. with. And, you know, the evidence seems to bear that out as well. So I think, you know, it's very much like we have now, you know, in communities of people that are involved. And, well, again, I could take something like Pantheacon as an example. You got a bunch of people together that are basically, you know, in similar sorts of religious and spiritual traditions, and everyone's kind of swapping ideas with everyone else. There's just a general idea that if you know something good, I would like to learn it and maybe try it out. And here's something I found that works. Maybe you'd like to try it out. So I think, you know, in many ways, ancient Greece and many of the ancient cultures were that way. They didn't have they had secrets, of course, but that's different from sort of a proprietary interest in ideas. So, you know, there certainly were guild secrets and ideas that were considered potentially dangerous and shouldn't be allowed out. But it was a different notion, I think, I don't think there was any notion of cultural appropriation, I guess is what I'm trying to say, because there wasn't perhaps such a strong notion of culture. I think people thought it more in terms of linguistic groups, but even there, there doesn't seem to be any reticence to borrow from other people that you may have come in contact with. You know, and assuming they wanted to tell you whatever it was, I'm talking about voluntary exchange of information. So I think, you know, that's, and when we have melting pots like Alexandria, this is where we see this huge ferment of different sorts of ideas. I mean, this is why it's so much trouble to, for instance, figure out the various sorts of Gnostic systems, because they're all borrowing ideas from each other and, you know, trying out different ideas and experimenting with them. And there was no authority that was going to basically tell them this is the one correct system here and all of the rest are wrong and should be stamped out. So I don't know. That's just some thoughts off the top of my head to maybe get us thinking a little bit about this. It's a different situation, I think, in the modern world where, you know, we do have marginalized cultures that have been historically marginalized and exploited in various sorts of ways. And I don't know if the problem didn't exist in ancient times, or they certainly don't seem to have been as aware of the problem in ancient times. But it's a distinct problem in the modern world, I think. And so that's, you know, I think what we need to think a little bit about, especially as we go about resurrecting and modernizing various sorts of ancient traditions.
Thank you. That's phenomenal. Tony?
As usual, Apollonius has given an excellent and comprehensive answer. So I'm just going to add on a few extra details. The ancient Greeks, in my opinion, appeared to be absolutely fascinated by the gods and cultures of the people around them. So whenever they would come across the gods of other nations, they would see them in the context of their own gods. So they would use the names of their own gods to describe those particular gods, because and it's almost like they originated the idea of archetypes. They would see similarities between the gods that they worked with and the gods of other people. So, for instance, you look at Zeus. Zeus is a storm god, leader of a pantheon. So he corresponds with Marduk, the Babylonian storm god, corresponds with Thor and Jupiter, and so on. The Greeks were also very open about having gotten influences from other sources. So if you look through the writings of Herodotus, he was an Egyptophile. So he stated that everything that the Greeks had, they had appropriated from the Egyptians. So whether that's true or not, there is certainly is a lot of influence, but he gave the Egyptians a hell of a lot of credit. Also, if you analyze the writings of Hesiod, you can see that rather than being taken from the Muses, they're actually taken from Near East sources. There are all sorts of similarities between Sumerian and Babylonian writings and his theogony. Now, the ancient Greeks were very conservative, so they normally didn't incorporate the gods of other pantheons, but if they wanted to, then they would have to consult with an oracle. And it was only once the oracle that was being consulted gave them permission to incorporate another god, they would do so, because the primary focus in ancient Greece was to maintain the status quo, keep things as they had always been. Now, regarding cultural appropriation, as Apollonius pointed out, it's very much a hot-button topic. It's extremely controversial, and I think it has to be looked at in a case-by-case basis. So when you have a dominant culture appropriating from a disadvantaged minority culture, then it's obviously wrong. So, for instance, you'll have white people in this country borrowing from the American Indians, you know, dressing up in the headgear of the indigenous peoples and so on. But I think you have to look at the motivation, whether it's being done for profit or whether it's something that's being done from the heart, something that honors the culture of those people. In my case, I don't have a particular culture, a particular religion to tap into. Yeah, the Christians wiped out the religion of my ancestors, so I had to go off and find something else. And the ancient religions, I never felt comfortable in Christianity, and the ancient religions that I resonated with were primarily those of the Greeks and the Egyptians. I had to find something that felt right for me. If I had a continuous tradition to tap into, then quite possibly I would, but unfortunately I don't. The Christians were very ruthless in wiping out many traditions. And even with the Greek religion that I'm tapping into, there are small survivals in villages, but most of it was pretty well wiped out by the Christians. So we're trying to recreate the practices. But the advantage that we have with the ancient Greek religion is that there is a huge amount of literary material that we can pour through, so that we can come up with something that approximates what the ancients were doing. Obviously, we can't copy exactly what they were doing. We're not going to incorporate slavery. We're not going to have public animal sacrifice. We're not going to have subjugation of women anymore. But we can incorporate the various principles that they use, such as reciprocity, being particularly pious and devout. Those are things that we definitely can do. And I think that so long as your heart is in the right place, I think it is okay to borrow from other cultures. But if you're doing it purely for profit, then that's when it's wrong. That's just my opinion, and I don't expect people to believe to accept it.
Well, still, it's an informed opinion, and it's well thought out. And you've brought up some points that are very worthy of consideration and further discussion. I'm confused by it. I'm Greek, and I was raised on this stuff, you know, since as far back as I can remember as a child. And I went to Greek parochial school. Being Greek is a full-time job. And despite the conversion to Christianity, most Greek households have tons of pagan gods all over their lawn, all over their house. So that they're proud of. They're proud of the ancient heritage. And I've been keeping away from the Greek pagan community. Because the two or three times I've tried to get involved with it and engage it, you know, I ran into very bizarre types of thinking. There were groups of people, and sometimes it expressed themselves individually or collectively, where what do you call it? The Greeks, because they converted to Christianity as a nation, weren't worthy successors to the heritage of their ancients. That's one thing I encountered again and again. Another thing is that the Greeks of today are not the same, you know, as the Greeks of yesteryear, even though we look the same as the statues, you know, pretty much. So there were all sorts of things being like thrown where if you were someone who's Greek and you were raised in this culture and it seeped into your pores, that somehow you were invalid in the eyes of many Greek pagans. And I even get that sometimes on folks I interview on the show, you know, who are tuned to the Greek pantheon. So that always puzzled me because as in antiquity, the Greeks related their gods to the gods they encountered and, you know, made those correspondences and looked for similarities. Even today, there's a movement called Hellenismos, not Hellenismos as you used the context in your book or as it's commonly understood, but Hellenismos means the spread of Greek culture. So there are groups like Ahepa, for instance, and you know, similar type of groups, where what they do is the elements in a culture that are from Greece, like for instance, you know, democracy, you know, whatever. They identify and celebrate those aspects as being like transplants into the, as Polonius was talking about earlier, into the new culture. But their roots go back to Elas, you know, so therefore these things need to be acknowledged and celebrated. So anyone who is feels an affinity with the Greeks is called a Philhellene. You know, that literally means friend of the Greeks. And so everyone is welcome, and the more Philhellenes you have, the better. So they're not excluding anybody. In order to get into, this has changed, by the way, but when I was growing up, in order to get into like a HEPA, you had to be very Greek and you had to go through all sorts of rigorous examinations. You know, a HEPA is the closest thing we had to like the Masons, I guess, for Greece. So it's always puzzled me because my culture is one of sharing or making equivalences to increase understanding. And I encountered what I shared just now, and then I also encountered, oh, you can't do that because you're not a whatever culture. You're not Scandinavian. You're not Celtic, you know, whatever I happen not to be. But I learned something by exploring the culture, and I saw something that could enhance my life and enhance my practice. And to some people, this was a very big no-no. That, you know, it's like I committed a spiritual crime. So anyway, that's where I stand on the matter. I understand with the minority groups and their culture and so forth, but the whole concept is alien to me. So I'm hoping to learn more by hearing you guys discussing it. Indeed, I have. I've gotten some keen insights and things to contemplate. How do we get past that? Because if we're trying to be universal, and I know that the theurgists that we have gathered here, you know, are trying to be more universal in their practice, even though still rooted in the ancient traditions and utilizing the ancient traditions. How do we create a culture among non-Christians, quote-unquote pagans, where this exchange and application of ideas, which happens anyway, as Apollonius pointed out, is more open and acceptable rather than, you know, being a cause for strife and discord?
Nobody knows.
Okay.
That's how I'm interpreting the silence. It is a hard problem, and I certainly don't have a simple answer to it. I think, you know, the motivation is very important, I think, and I think Tony brought up a really good point. I mean, if it looks like somebody is exploiting another culture that's not their own for profit and only for profit, then that's a pretty good sign that what they're doing is exploitation. I think another factor that I've been thinking about is what do the representatives of that culture, what do they want to do? If they want to share it and say, well, look, here's a practice, we do this, you know, you might find it worthwhile also, you know, again, in an appropriate context, I'm more willing to adopt something from another culture if it's essentially been offered as a gift, so to speak.
Okay.
Saying we are happy if you adopt this practice or this idea. And now granted, you know, that not everyone who's representing some marginalized or discriminated against culture are going to agree. Some people may want to not share anything in that sort of way, and others will. And I think we've seen this, for example, even in, for example, the Native American culture. There have been some spiritual leaders in Native American cultures that have been happy to sort of suggest that non-Native Americans adopt some of their practices, and others have not been so willing. So I think that, you know, that's one indicator, is are we accepting a gift that at least some of them think should be shared? Or are we essentially going in and stealing something? The other thing I think, and I've tried to do this work primarily within the Greek framework, the Hellenistic framework, but I try and learn as much as I can from other spiritual traditions as well. But I try and understand what's going on and essentially separate it from the other cultural context so that I can either find something in my case, the Greek context that corresponds, or perhaps it creates something that's based on sort of the core ideas without, adopting all of the cultural specifics from the other case as well. Then I feel like I'm more learning as opposed to taking something or stealing something. But these are the kinds of things I think about, you know, in my own practice. I think I've mentioned before that I found Tibetan Buddhism to be very informative. And but, you know, I don't, by and large, practice as a Tibetan Buddhist or use, you know, a lot of the specific forms that are used in Tibetan Buddhism. But I try and understand what's going on and say, okay, you know, how would an ancient Greek or a modern Greek pagan have done this, and then and do it that way. So I, you know, that's kind of my ad hoc way of approaching some of these problems. And, you know, it, but I do think about it a lot, and because I'm not ethnically Greek, and so as opposed to you, Hercules, you know, I could be considered to be basically exploiting a culture that's not my own. I'm Anglo-Saxon Celtic.
I don't see it that way.
Well, I
see the opposite. You are keeping the fires of antiquity alive. You know, so how can that be a bad thing? You know, that's an awesome thing. You know, I salute you and I respect you for it.
Well, thank you, and I hope that that's what I'm doing. That's certainly what I strive to do. You know, I look at the ancient world, and you know, Alexander spread Greek culture, you know, off as far as India and Egypt, and into you know, Italy, of course, and you know, and then later the Roman Empire spread the Roman forms of the same gods in many cases, all the way up into the United Kingdom, or what was to become the United Kingdom, the British Isles. So this culture was spread all over half the world, we might say, or a third of the world, by the people that owned it, so to speak. And so that indicates to me that this is a religious tradition that wants to spread around.
Yes.
And so I've taken that essentially, you know, as sort of a license, if you will, to do what I've tried to do, stay true to the original tradition, but then also understand it in more modern terms. But it's a hard problem, I think. You know.
And one which we'll revisit. We're running out of time for today. I want to give Tony a chance to react to what you said, and then we'll share contact information. Tony?
I really like Apollonius's idea of being offered a gift of either a cultural or religious practice from some sort of minority group. Obviously, if it's given to you as a gift, it's given to you in the right spirit, and you're not ripping anything off from a disadvantaged culture. Now, Hercules, you mentioned towards the end of your speech, not the last one, but the one before that,
okay,
talked about people being excluded on the basis of nationality or color, and in particular, the people who work with the Norse gods come to mind. They actively exclude people who, you know, are dark skinned or what have you, because they believe that only those with white skin should be venerating the Norse gods. What I was referring to previously was that I've come across references to organizations in Greece that don't like to have people not from a Greek background,
yes,
venerating the Greek gods. So that's sort of what I was referring to. And like Apollonius, I don't have a Greek background either. You know, so I'm one of these people who sort of come in, and I'm doing what I can to keep the ancient Greek fires burning. I try to be very respectful, but I don't have any Greek blood coursing through my veins. But
that doesn't matter. The definition of who was Greek varied widely in antiquity, usually meant if there was Greek cultural influence and you were part of the Hellenic world, so you were Greek if you wanted to be Greek.
Yeah. I'd like to be Greek, yeah.
There you go. So I dub you Greek.
All right, Antonius.
There we go. And now we only have a couple of minutes left. If you could kindly share your contact information, and then Apollonius, if you could share yours. Again, the time goes too quickly.
Best way to get in contact with me is through Facebook, either my personal page or my author page. And I also have a blog on Pathos called Holistic Spirituality. So you can keep up to date with what I'm writing.
Thank you very much, Apollonius.
And the best ways to get a hold of me are through my two websites. One is wisdomofhypatia.com. Hypatia is H-Y-P-A-T-I-A, and that's all one word, Wisdom of Hypatia. And the other one is opsopaus.com. That's O-P-S-O-P-A-U-S.com. And you can email me through those websites.
And there is a wealth of information on those websites because they link to earlier websites as well. And those early websites have to be experienced to be believed. So thank you, both of you, for doing all that you do to keep the flames of antiquity alive. I'm honored to be with you on this podcast, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Yeah, I do, too.
Likewise.
Thank
you.
Be well, and thanks to everybody who joined us tonight, whether you joined us live or whether you're going to join us later on in demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And for the couple of minutes we have left, I'm going to play Linnell Griffin's Mighty Elohim.
Sound the trumpet.